This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran's broadcasting. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily via the internet address www.parstoday.com/en. You can also listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Intelsat 902, and Eutelsat satellite, as well as via internet. You can also listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for more details.
Here we enlighten you with ayahs 261 and 262 from the Surah Baqarah, recited by Ali Parhiskar.
A'udhu billahi minash shaytanir rajeem. Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim. مَثَلُ الَّذِينَ يُنفِقُونَ أَمْوَالَهُمْ فِي سَبِيلِ اللَّهِ كَمَثَلِ حَبَّةٍ أَنبَتَتْ سَبْعَ سَنَابِلَ كَمَثَلِ حَبَّةٍ أَنبَتَتْ سبع سنابل في كل سنبلة مئة حبة والله يضاعف لمن يشاء والله واسع عليم مثل الذين ينفقون أموالهم في سبيل الله كمثل حبة أنبتت سبع سنابل كمثل حبة أنبتت سبع سنابل في كل سنبلة مئة حبة والله يضاعف لمن يشاء والله واسع عليم الذين ينفقون أموالهم في سبيل الله ثم لا يتبعون ما أنفقوا منا ولا أذى قوما ولا أذى لهم أجرهم عند ربهم ولا خوف عليهم ولا هم يحزنون صدق الله العلي العظيم.
In the name of God, the most gracious, the most compassionate. The parable of those who spend their property in the way of Allah is as the parable of the grain growing 7 years, with 100 grains in every ear. And Allah multiplies for whom He pleases, and Allah is ample giving, knowing. As for those who spend their property in the way of Allah, then do not follow what they have spent with reproach or injury. They shall have their reward from their Lord, and they shall have no fear, nor shall they grieve.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.
Headlines: a series of rockets have hit the Afghan capital Kabul, killing at least one person and wounding another. The US Supreme Court rejects a lawsuit filed by the state of Texas seeking to overturn presidential vote results in 4 key states. Also ahead, Iran slams the US for vowing to keep the pressure on the International Atomic Energy Agency about Tehran's nuclear program, calling Washington's policy, quote, extremely harmful. It's good to have you with us. Our top story this hour: a series of rockets have hit the Afghan capital Kabul, killing at least one person and wounding another. According to the Interior Ministry, at least 4 rockets were fired from northern Kabul and landed in central and eastern parts of the city. 2 of the projectiles struck near the Kabul airport and the other 2 hit a residential area. The ministry added the assault was the second such attack to rock the capital in less than a month. No group has claimed the attack so far, but the Afghan government has implicitly blamed the Taliban militant group for the assault. Our correspondent Amin Alami says talks are still underway between the Afghan government and the Taliban militant group in a bid to ensure peace and security in the war-ravaged country.
An ongoing intra-Afghan talks is underway between the Taliban militant group and the Afghan peace delegation in the Qatari capital, Doha. Despite they have reached some agreements regarding to the main agenda of talks, there are different arguments regarding to the possible emerge of peace in Afghanistan, here in Afghanistan, because many have believed that many other players, excluding Taliban, are also after their interests in Afghanistan, and some of them are following their interests via war and spreading violence and bloodshed in this country. So they need to support and they need to have terrorist groups to fight with them and follow their interests in this country. In such circumstances, they want the Afghan government, independent bodies, and even regional and regional countries and international community to put an end to the decades-long violence in this country and pay respect to the lives of civilians in Afghanistan.
Elsewhere, the Chinese Foreign Ministry has dismissed U.S. criticism of Beijing's human rights record as blatant hypocrisy.
The US practices on human rights have demonstrated to the whole world what textbook human rights hypocrisy looks like.
The remarks follow a social media post by the US Embassy in Beijing regarding human rights in China. Chinese Foreign Ministry spokesperson stressed that under the gloom of the COVID-19 pandemic, people's right to life is the most important of all human rights. She described the coronavirus-related fatalities in the United States as shocking and saddening. Beijing says it always puts human lives first and makes the best possible efforts to protect their safety and dignity. Commentator Anna Tengen says new U.S. anti-China sanctions are Trump's last efforts to make it more difficult for the next administration to normalize ties with Beijing.
This promises to be an ongoing tension line, and it's not surprising that the embassy is trying to exacerbate this. It's part of, I believe, Trump's belief that he can control things after he is forced out of the office on January 20th. So he wants to exacerbate this issue of human rights and tensions between the U.S. and China so that it's more difficult for a Biden administration to come to some sort of pragmatic way of dealing with the economy, the environment, health, peace initiatives, and multilateral trade initiatives.
In other news, the U.S. Food and Drug Administration has authorized the emergency use of a COVID-19 vaccine jointly produced by American drug maker Pfizer and its German partner BioNTech. The approval will pave the way for millions to be vaccinated in the world's hardest hit country. The coronavirus pandemic has killed nearly 300,000 Americans so far. The U.S. is seeking to inoculate 20 million people this month. Healthcare workers and elderly people in care facilities are at the front of the line to receive shots. The U.S. is now the sixth country to approve the vaccine after Britain, Bahrain, Canada, Saudi Arabia, and Mexico. The government says it is buying 100 million more doses of a second vaccine produced by Moderna. The two-shot regimen could be approved as early as next week. Staying in the United States, where Americans have hit the streets in the state of Ohio to demand transparency in the investigation of the fatal police shooting of a black man.
Justice for Casey!
Justice for Casey!
The protesters chanted slogans against police racism as they marched towards the Ohio State House in the city of Columbus. 23-year-old Casey Christopher was killed last week after a sheriff's deputy shot him multiple times outside his home. Authorities and the victim's family have offered conflicting stories about the circumstances leading to his death. Anger mounts despite Columbus officials promising an unbiased investigation into the death. This is the latest in a series of police killing of African Americans in the U.S. The country has witnessed mass protests against racial injustice and police brutality over the past months. The Texas Republican Party chief has suggested forming a union of states after the U.S. Supreme Court rejects bid by Texas to overturn the results of the presidential election. In a statement, Ellen West said the Supreme Court's order had established a precedent that allows states to violate the Constitution and not to be held accountable. He said perhaps law-abiding states should form a union that will abide by the Constitution. This came after the Supreme Court's rejection of Texas's lawsuit to overturn Joe Biden's victory in the states of Georgia, Michigan, Pennsylvania, and Wisconsin. The ruling is considered as a crushing setback for Trump's quest to undo his election loss to President-elect Joe Biden. Trump's team has already suffered multiple court defeats in similar cases in other states. However, Trump still refuses to concede continuing fraud claims. Elsewhere, Iran's ambassador to the International Atomic Energy Agency has slammed the U.S. for calling for pressure on the agency regarding Tehran's nuclear program. In a tweet, Kazem Gharibabadi said the U.S. pressure on the IAEA is detrimental to the interests of the entire international community. Gharibabadi called on the agency to withstand Washington's pressure and remain independent. He cited June 2019 comments by the late Director General of the IAEA, who had described attempts to put pressure on the body as counterproductive and extremely harmful. The Iranian envoy said it is now clear what Yukiya Amano was talking about. This comes after U.S. Special Representative on Iran, Elliot Abrams, said Washington should coordinate with the European signatories to the 2015 nuclear deal to keep pressing the IAEA regarding Iran's nuclear activities. Correspondent Homer Lesgi says Iran has time and again stressed that the IAEA should not turn into a political entity under U.S. pressure.
This is something that Iran has been mentioning again and again in statements that have been delivered by the Iranian ambassador himself to the IAEA's board of governors, that there is pressure on the agency when it comes to Iran, and that the agency should remain independent and impartial and professional, should not turn from a technical organization into a political entity. And in the reference that he made to the remarks of Yukiya Amano, the late director general, he had also made the same remark. He had used the word micromanaging, saying that there is an effort to micromanage the agency without at the time mentioning any country or person specifically. And now Mr. Ghali Bobadi saying it's clear from these comments who Mr. Amano was referring to. It was the United States who was trying to do that, and it's continuing to basically dictate the policies of the IAEA, especially when it comes to Iran. This is the Iranian position on this issue.
Lebanon's Hezbollah resistance movement has condemned Morocco's move to normalize ties with Israel, pledging continued support for the Palestinian cause. Hezbollah branded normalization deals with Tel Aviv as treacherous steps in line with the U.S. and the Israeli regime's desire to eradicate the Palestinian cause. The resistance movement said Morocco and a few other Arab states which have normalized ties with Israel will gain nothing but disappointment from submission to U.S. and Israeli blackmail. Hezbollah also warned that Muslim nations continue to reject all forms of normalization with Israel and will ensure the deals will fall apart.
Morocco has become the fourth Arab country to normalize relations with Israel since August in a U.S. brokered agreement. U.S. President Donald Trump announced the agreement on Twitter Thursday. He said Rabat and Tel Aviv have agreed to fall diplomatic relations, calling the move a historic breakthrough. Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu also called the deal historic. Morocco said under the agreement, it will take concrete steps to resume a relationship with Israel on several levels. In return, the U.S. decided to recognize Morocco's sovereignty over the entire Western Sahara. The Polisario Front independence movement that holds a fifth of the region strongly condemned the deal. The movement said Trump has attributed to Morocco something that does not belong to the country. Palestinians denounced the agreement too. The Palestine Liberation Organization said Morocco's decision was unacceptable. It said the move will increase Israel's belligerence and its denial of the Palestinian people's rights. Resistance movement Hamas said Israel uses every new normalization deal to increase its aggression against Palestinians. The Islamic Jihad movement also denounced Morocco's decision as a betrayal to the Islamic and Arab world. In Yemen, the Ansar Allah movement said there isn't any justification for Arab states to establish ties with Israel. Inside Morocco, many people are critical of normalization with Israel. During a demonstration in the capital Rabat in September, protesters called Bahrain and the United Arab Emirates treacherous countries for establishing diplomatic relations with Israel. Many believe U.S. brokered normalization agreements aim to eliminate Palestinians from the entire region.
Israel doesn't want peace. Israel wants territory, power, and it wants genocide. It wants to eliminate Palestinians, preferably 100%. If not by killing them, then by making them forget that they're Palestinian.
The UAE announced its decision to establish diplomatic ties with Israel in August. In return, Washington provided Abu Dhabi with F-35 fighter jets. Bahrain and Sudan followed suit, with Sudan being removed from the U.S. blacklist of terrorism-sponsored countries. On Thursday, White House senior advisor Jared Kushner said a similar deal is inevitable between Israel and Saudi Arabia. For now, it's unclear what privileges Riyadh will be given to normalize relations with Tel Aviv.
And the Syria's envoy to the United Nations says the Organization for the Prohibition of Chemical Weapons has become a tool for the United States and its allies. Bashar al-Jafari made the remarks during a video conference at the UN Security Council, where the OPCW accused Damascus of not declaring all its chemical weapons activities. Jafari called on the organization to close Syria's file and highlighted the country's commitment to cooperating with the UN body. Russia's ambassador to the UN also rejected the OPCW's claims as speculations and political smear campaigns. Bazali Nabanzia said the UN body relies on remote investigations instead of on-site collections of samples. Russia and Syria also criticized the OPCW's past reports for serving as a platform for Western attacks on Syria. Iran has executed a man who was convicted of corruption on earth, a charge used in cases involving serious offenses such as espionage or attempts to overthrow the government. Ruhollah Zam was sentenced to death by a court in June after several sessions. Zam faced charges of committing offenses against the country's internal and external security, spying for the French intelligence agencies, and insulting Islamic sanctities. He had also created an anti-Iran website, Ahmad News, which was found publishing misleading contents against the Islamic Republic. Authorities say his online work helped inspire deadly anti-government protests in 2017. Zam left for France in 2009 following the post-election unrest in Iran. He was arrested last year and enticed back to the country through a complicated intelligence trap.
Death penalty. This was the sentence handed down to Ruhollah Zam for administrating a news website that Iran's judiciary says disseminates misleading content against the Islamic Republic. Ahmad News came to prominence during Iran's nationwide protests in 2017, which were driven by economic grievances. The Iranian government says the news network was inciting, quote, armed uprising against the establishment, while spreading damaging information about government officials.
During the 2017 unrest in Iran, Ahmad News Telegram channel frequently shared the time schedule for protests across Iran and detailed how they went down. It also regularly published videos from the protests, and Ahmad News Terwat was a peaceful demand for economic reforms into violent protests which were associated with vandalism and looting.
Zam left Iran for France following the 2009 post-election unrest in Iran. The Iranian judiciary says he was under the instructions and protection of intelligence services of France, Israel, and the U.S. Zam faced charges of having committed offenses against Iran's internal and external security, spying for the French intelligence service, and desecrating Islamic sanctities.
Ruhollah Zam was actually a small piece of a large puzzle that sought to bring about a regime change in Iran. I believe he fell into a trap spread by the CIA, Mossad, and especially the French intelligence agency. He became part of the United States' so-called 2020 project that was aimed at toppling the Islamic Republic through a soft war in a three-time mark of 1999, 2009, and finally 2019.
Zam was arrested in October 2019 by the intelligence organization of Iran's Islamic Revolution Guards Corps. The IRGC says Zam was detained after being enticed into the country as part of a complicated intelligence trap. Iran's Supreme Court upheld the death sentence 5 months after the Islamic Revolution Courthouse issued the verdict for corruption on earth, a term used to describe capital crimes within the Iranian judicial system.
Ruhollah Zam will be executed, and there will be no change in the court's ruling whatsoever. Meanwhile, Ahmad News is still up and running, something which gives some clues that Zam was just a pawn in a wider game, orchestrated from outside Iran's borders. Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Brings an end to our bulletin for this hour. Thank you for staying tuned.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Saturdays. In the name of Allah, the Beneficent, the Merciful. Bismillah, words that seekers of sanctuary repeatedly recite, words that the very cautious in search of protection often repeat. I seek refuge with Allah, the Exalted above all, from the oppression of the unjust, from the deceitful malice the envious use to lay snares and traps, from the injustice and outrage of the tyrants, and I sing his praise. Do better and go beyond other praisers. O Allah, thou art one, has no partner, and is the Lord and Master without being made. There is no discrepancy or nonsense in thy commands, nor there is lawlessness in thy kingdom. I beseech thee to send blessings on Muhammad, thy servant, thy messenger. To let me ask thee for enlightenment and inspiration, so as to be thankful for thy bounties, which alone get thy approval ultimately. To help me to obey thee, and instinctively worship thee, and make me deserve thy rewards on account of thy very patronage. And have mercy on me, and prevent me from breaking in the bounds of thy prohibitions, as far as I am kept alive, and show the way unto that which is useful and advantageous till I go on survive. To let me take to heart the meanings of thy book, and by its reading, throw down the heavy burden of sins, and receive welfare and salvation as a gift. Let not my family and friends who love me leave me alone. Let thy favors reach me in abundance during the remainder of my life, exactly as they used to be made available for me in full in the days gone by. Oh, the most merciful.
In the limelight.
The United Nations top official on torture on Tuesday, December 8, called for British authorities to release or place under house arrest WikiLeaks founder Julian Assange, citing the risk of COVID-19 infection in London's notorious Belmarsh prison and condemning a decade of arbitrary deprivation of liberty that has severely violated the jail journalist's human rights. The WikiLeaks founder's prolonged solitary confinement in a high-security prison is neither necessary nor proportionate, said United Nations Special Rapporteur on Torture Nils Melzer. Dear listeners, stay with us for an article in this regard written by Brett Wilkins Ryder. This article is published under the heading, Not a Criminal. Top UN Anti-Torture Official Urges Julian Assange Release. Here's the details.
Thank you.
The United Nations top official on torture on Tuesday, December 8, called for British authorities to release or place under house arrest WikiLeaks founder Julian Assange, citing the risk of COVID-19 infection in London's notorious Belmarsh prison and condemning a decade of arbitrary deprivation of liberty that has severely violated the jailed journalist's human rights. UN Special Rapporteur on Torture Niels Melzer's comments came in a statement noting reports that some 65 of the 165 inmates at Belmarsh, including numerous prisoners in the wing where Assange is jailed, have tested positive for coronavirus. Assange's legal team has repeatedly called for his release, citing pre-existing health conditions, including heart problems and respiratory infections that place the 49-year-old journalist and publisher at elevated risk for potentially deadly COVID-19 complications. The UN Working Group on Arbitrary Detention previously found that Assange had been arbitrarily deprived of his freedom since his arrest on December 7, 2010, including house arrest, imprisonment in London, and 7 years spent receiving political asylum in the Ecuadorian embassy in the British capital. Assange has been imprisoned in Belmarsh in conditions described by Melzer as near total isolation since April 2019, as he awaits a UK court's decision on whether he will be extradited to the United States to face charges of violating the 1917 Espionage Act and the Computer Fraud and Abuse Act for publishing classified US military documents and files on WikiLeaks a decade ago. Among the materials published by WikiLeaks are the Afghanistan and Iraq war logs, which revealed U.S. and coalition war crimes, many of them leaked by Army whistleblower Chelsea Manning. Perhaps the most infamous of the leaks is the so-called collateral murder video, which shows U.S. Army attack helicopter crews laughing as they gunned down a group of Iraqi civilians that included journalists and children. While the soldiers and commanders implicated in the materials published by the WikiLeaks have largely enjoyed impunity, Manning served 7 years in prison before her sentence was commuted by outgoing President Barack Obama in 2017. Meanwhile, Assange faces up to 175 years behind bars if found guilty of all charges against him. The British authorities initially detained Ms. Assange on the basis of an arrest warrant issued by Sweden in connection with allegations of sexual misconduct that have since been formally dropped due to lack of evidence, Melzer said in a statement. Today, he is detained for exclusively preventative purposes to ensure his presence during the ongoing U.S. extradition trial, a proceeding which may well last several years. Mr. Assange is not a criminal convict and poses no threat to anyone. So his prolonged solitary confinement in a high-security prison is neither necessary nor proportionate and clearly lacks any legal basis, Melzer continued. There have been growing calls for President Donald Trump to pardon Assange during his last week in office, including by exiled former National Security Agency whistleblower Edward Snowden, filmmaker Oliver Stone, and musician Roger Waters. Melzer, who has repeatedly called Assange's treatment torture, added that the whistleblower's rights have been severely violated for more than a decade. Additionally, Melzer advised British authorities to decline the U.S. extradition request, citing serious human rights concerns in a nation whose prisons are rife with torture, rape, and other abuses. He must now be allowed to live in a normal way, normal family, social, and professional life, to recover his health and to adequately prepare his defense against the U.S. extradition request pending against him, he said.
This is IRIB English Radio.
IRIB English Radio. With you every single moment.
European News Bulletin.
My name is Saeed Puruza. Our top story, we begin in the Swedish capital, Stockholm, where Nobel Prizes have been awarded for achievements in various fields over the course of the year. While the ceremony brought some much-needed cheer in a year riddled with so much difficulty, concerns surrounding next year's humanitarian challenges are never too far away. Morteza Jaffer starts us off.
So many times before,
as the year comes to a close, so too does the Nobel Peace Prize ceremony. Only this time history was made with the committee in Sweden while the laureates appeared on screen socially distant across the globe. Awards were handed for numerous categories, but the feature standout remains the Peace Prize. In this pandemic year, with economies reeling and record numbers of refugees fleeing war, famine and disease, the UN World Food Programme were awarded the prize for their efforts tackling hunger across the globe.
Wow. Waking up this morning in this beautiful city here in Rome, it's hard to imagine that in about 400 AD, this city experienced a massive famine. It ended up killing almost 90% of its population. It's hard to imagine us going through a famine like that. But my tragic duty today is to tell you, famine is at humanity's doorstep for millions and millions of people on Earth. Because of so many wars, climate change, the widespread use of hunger as a political and military weapon, and a global health pandemic that makes all of that exponentially worse, 270 million people are marching towards starvation. Failure to address their needs will cause a hunger pandemic which will dwarf the impact of COVID.
270 million people is equivalent to the combined populations of the UK, Germany, France, and Italy, all at the brink of starvation. What's more, the coronavirus pandemic has sharply escalated the severity of the crisis. As senior UN officials convened at the General Assembly, the message was clear. 2021 is shaping up to be an even greater humanitarian catastrophe as global coronavirus cases continue to accelerate. With vaccines offering a way out, the fear remains that poorer nations will be left behind.
We simply cannot accept a world in which the poor and marginalized are trampled by the rich and powerful in the stampede for vaccines. This is a global crisis, and the solutions must be shared equitably as global public goods, not as private commodities that widen inequalities and become yet another reason some people are left behind.
A According to the UN, global measures to tackle the virus have fueled a 40% increase in the number of people relying on humanitarian help, and have appealed once again for wealthier nations to assist developing countries struggling to cope. Vaccines are currently being administered in the UK, Canada, and Russia, with various Western nations soon to begin the rollout. However, the nature of the pandemic is such, failing to tackle the problem globally will only mean the threat of another wave that will only delay a return back to normal.
A pandemic that will dwarf the impact of the coronavirus pandemic. Much of the Jaffer there. Speaking of the coronavirus pandemic, it has affected everyone's life one way or another, but it's dealt a heavier blow to some more than others. Food charities in the UK are referring to them as the newly hungry, a growing cohort of people previously in good jobs and enjoying decent incomes. The hardest hit among them, families with children.
A typical day in the life of mother of four, Naomi Rantry, founder and CEO of Educare Family Support Service, a fundraiser in West London that uses public donations to help children and families during the pandemic.
We started this food parcel delivery in May. So we did that for about 13 weeks. The numbers were just increasing. We started on 7 on our first week, and it ended up being 200 every week.
First stop, a school. Earlier this year, the British government had to reverse its decision not to offer free school meals in the Christmas holidays, following a campaign by football star Marcus Rashford. Still, more help is needed.
If there's an issue financially, we could support them with maybe some debt management, some financial assistance. In other areas, it might be school uniform they need support with.
People who use food banks are generally double-income, low-wage earners. In struggling families, all it takes is for one parent to lose their job. Karina used to work in the tourism sector in central London.
I used to work part-time on a zero-hours contract, and it was like a normal life for me. Now I'm on a minus because I've stopped working. I had to ask for help. I never knew about food bank. I just found out since I was on a financial difficulty.
Living in a nondescript apartment in West London, Karina, whose husband does food deliveries, not only has to care for her three-year-old daughter, but also her ailing father who lives alone.
Everything starts to go really bad with him. Sorry, I'm crying. And because I'm the one who's obliged, you know, to help him, to look after him, because he's my only parent.
The Trussell Trust, that runs 1,200 of the UK's 2,000 food banks, say they gave out more than 1 million emergency food packages between April and September. Nearly 500,000 went to children. They also warned these figures are the tip of the iceberg.
Nearly 2 million people have used a food bank in the UK in the past year, almost 300,000 more than the year before. While the government has taken steps, charities say they're not enough, which is why they're relying on donations from the public to try and tackle hunger in the world's sixth largest economy.
In the absence of an income, many adults living with children in this country have reported skipping meals in the last 8 months. It's the last month of the year, and the nation of nearly 67 million is gearing up for Christmas. Without adequate government support and with food banks under strain, poverty may well rear its ugly head in more British homes. Saeed Pourreza, London.
UK Prime Minister Boris Johnson has warned that there is now a strong possibility that Britain will crash out of the EU without a trade deal at the end of the year. He said British firms should carefully prepare for what's to come after December 31st. Wading into the squabble, EU Commission Chief Ursula von der Leyen spoke of the key issues between the two sides earlier today.
Positions remain apart on fundamental issues. On the level playing field, we have repeatedly made clear to our UK partners that the principle of fair competition is a precondition to privileged access to the EU market. It is the largest single market in the world, and it is only fair that competitors to our own enterprises face the same conditions on our own market.
The two sides have set this Sunday as the deadline for an agreement and said they didn't believe talks would continue beyond that. The Netherlands-based UN Special Tribunal for Lebanon has sentenced a member of the Hezbollah resistance movement to life for alleged involvement in the 2005 assassination of former Lebanese Prime Minister Rafiq Hariri. The sentencing comes months after a hearing convicted Salim Ayash in absentia of being involved in the suicide truck bombing on Beirut's seafront that killed Hariri and 21 others. The investigation has been criticized for its lack of evidence linking Ayash to the bombing. Hezbollah have repeatedly denied any involvement. The French Foreign Minister, Jean-Yves Le Drian, has defended the government's controversial new anti-radicalization law, saying that accusations of Islamophobia against the bill are largely misrepresented. France has faced a fierce backlash from Muslim leaders across the world after it presented legislation it says will clamp down on, quote, radical Islam. New measures to be imposed will include tightening rules on religious-based education and registering mosques as places of worship. France has been accused of being Islamophobic after President Emmanuel Macron defended blasphemous cartoons of the Prophet Muhammad and described Islam as being in crisis. The European Union has extended sanctions against Russia by another 6 months. European Council President Charles Michel announced that EU leaders had agreed to impose a wave of new sanctions targeting the Russian economy, including the oil sector. The new measures will continue until the end of July next year. The move comes days after the U.S. imposed further bans on several Russian individuals and entities. Moscow's ambassador to Washington, Anatoly Antonov, has warned the move will further deepen the crisis in relations between the two world powers.
This is European News Bulletin broadcast by IRIB English Radio. In this program, we covered the most recent developments all over Europe. You can listen to this program on Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday, and Saturday.
After the United Arab Emirates, Bahrain, and Sudan, Morocco has become the fourth Arab country to strike a deal to establish full diplomatic relations with, guess whom? Israel. Another gift to Benjamin Netanyahu from the outgoing Trump administration in the U.S., condemned by Palestinians, Iran, and all those loyal to the Palestinian struggle. Robert Nwakesh has been keeping his ear to the ground and joins me now with more details on that story. Robert, good to see you.
Good to see you too, Saeed. And this move has been described as another stab in the back of the Palestinian people and the Palestinian cause by the Arab regimes, and of course makes it harder for the Arab Peace Initiative to work if it was a so-called two-state solution that they were aiming for the international community. And we see little condemnation from the international community of these moves as of recently. But before we go further into this story, let's play a clip of Benjamin Netanyahu, the Israeli premier himself, announcing this. And he's very happy with himself. So check it out.
I've always believed that this historic day would come. I've always worked for it. I want to first thank President Trump for his extraordinary efforts to expand peace, to bring peace to Israel and the peoples of the Middle East.
He says he knew this day would come, Robert.
Well, this has been in the planning for some time now, and of course Donald Trump is doing all he can whilst he is in office to put Netanyahu in a favorable position to his own population. But less on that and more on the fact that he said peace in the region, which is quite a funny thing because the Western Sahara now, the occupied Western Sahara, has just been declared by the U.S. Trump administration to belong to Morocco, and that would mean essentially that the hundreds of thousands of refugees, Sahrawi refugees, which are currently living in Algeria, would essentially be remain as refugees for the foreseeable future.
About that, what does a recognition by a U.S. administration of a country's sovereignty over a region in this case, Moroccan sovereignty over West Sahara, mean?
Well, of course, it doesn't have international recognition. Western Sahara, as a independent nation, has backing by the international community to say that it should be an independent state and should be a UN member. However, we have seen that the Polisario Front, which is the National Liberation Movement for Western Sahara, has not been ever granted that ability to come to a vote. And at this moment right now, we've seen just, and it's not a coincidence, that just in the past months, the ceasefire, the 30-year-long ceasefire which held, has broken down. And guess who's involved in that? The United Arab Emirates, who have just placed their consulate over in Western Sahara on behalf of the Moroccans. The Morocco as well, we have to understand, trying to get closer to the U.S. Trump administration and being pressured on the issue, in 2017 abandoned ties with Iran. And now we see this after the United Arab Emirates have made such a push and had been backing Morocco on the issue so hard. And even there's allegations that UAE fighter jets were used to bombard positions in the Western Sahara. So this is something that has been in the making for some time. And when Netanyahu talks about peace, what peace has come out of this?
That's a very good point, Robert, isn't it? Basically, what they're saying is you want F-35s, you got to have Benjamin Netanyahu's number. You want 14,000 bombs, in the case of the UAE buying those bombs from the Americans, call Netanyahu, because they have clout, the Israeli lobby, whatever, they have clout in the American administration, and they can really deliver the goods.
Absolutely. And the UAE, when it comes to building bridges for other so-called peace deals to be put on the table, is the perfect asset to have in the Middle East. Its intelligence agency operates. It has a vast intelligence apparatus. And we even saw in the case of Sudan normalization, that was largely due to UAE influence in Sudan, which many people don't really hear about, and many people don't even understand. And when it comes to Morocco, yet again, we see UAE fingerprints there, because the UAE is working on behalf of Israel. And of course, this deal for the UAE has meant opening up of more trade relationships for the United Arab Emirates and weapons, like you said.
All right, take us online and some online reaction.
The first one we have here says, and this is from an Israeli user, they say, diplomatic ties with Israel gets the UAE stealth jets, Morocco, Western Sahara, Sudan sanctions relief, and then Bahrain Chabad House. Bit of a stab there. And then we've got a reply to this from a user called Mo, who says, Sudan hasn't gotten anything tangible. The U.S. uses a stick and the image of a carrot approach with the government of Sudan. Basically a blackmail policy that mostly the Sudanese people pay for rather than the government, typically a U.S. foreign policy. We have another one commenting on this issue here as well, a user called Khalil, who says, UN stance on Western Sahara remains unchanged. The UN spokesperson ruins Morocco's colonial regime, rejoicing over usual anarchic personal proclamations of real Donald Trump. That's his Twitter handle, legally gifting it what he does not possess, the occupied Western Sahara.
And this whole thing, Robert, what it does is really calls into question the relevance of the United Nations, because no one seems to be listening to the UN. You said something earlier about the UAE working on behalf of Israel. But what can also be said about this whole thing is the American administration, the Trump administration, over the past 4 years, using its influence around the world to benefit Israel, or from an Israeli standpoint, Benjamin Netanyahu and his band of Likud party members using American influence to their own benefit.
Absolutely. And we have a piece now on that and what Donald Trump has delivered for Israel during his time in office. And of course, this is ongoing, as we've seen with this story on Morocco. So more on that now.
As Donald Trump nears the end of his time as President of the United States, he continues to tighten U.S. support for Israel. But what exactly has Trump done in office that has made him the most pro-Israel president in U.S. history? Let's take a look at what Trump's pro-Israel record looks like. Whilst in office, Trump notably recognized Israel's undivided capital as being Jerusalem al-Quds in December of 2017, later moving the U.S. embassy there from Tel Aviv in May of 2018. Donald J. Trump then also unilaterally withdrew from the Iran nuclear deal, or JCPOA, at the behest of Netanyahu and the Israel lobby in the United States. As president, he also saw it fit to kick out the PLO from their office in Washington, D.C. This is prior to him structuring a so-called peace deal, which was supposed to, in the words of Trump, favor both the Israelis and Palestinians. In June of 2018, U.S. Ambassador to the United Nations Nikki Haley announced that the U.S. was withdrawing from the UN Human Rights Council, citing biased criticism of Israel being one of the principal reasons for the U.S. doing so. Whilst the embassy move was ongoing, a massacre was committed of Palestinian peaceful protesters in Gaza, as Israeli snipers targeted and murdered over 60 unarmed demonstrators, including journalists and medics. Trump's administration sat by throughout the entire course of what was to be named the Great Return March in Gaza, constituting one of the largest, by percentage of the besieged Gazan population, nonviolent protest movements in history. The Trump administration defended Israel repeatedly, claiming that Israel was under attack and defended itself. This is despite a UNHRC report, as well as countless human rights group reports, categorically debunking this as a lie. The silence on the part of the U.S. Trump administration amounted to Israel murdering at least 330 unarmed demonstrators, injuring 35,000. No Israelis were significantly injured or killed. The United States not only cheered on Israel as it massacred the people of the Gaza Strip, but went a step further. In August of 2018, Trump withdrew all funding from UNRWA, or the UN agency set up to help Palestinian refugees. Gaza's population is a 70-plus percent population of refugees. In 2019, Trump signed an order recognizing the illegally occupied Golan Heights as being Israeli territory, contrary to international law, which stipulates that the land belongs to Syria. Donald Trump's Secretary of State Mike Pompeo also announced that it is not per se inconsistent with international law in regard to the U.S.'s position on Israel's illegal occupation of the West Bank, and that settlements were not illegal. In February of 2019, Trump also decided to cut funds altogether of any kind from going to Palestinians in the occupied territories. This meant a full defunding of the Palestinian Authority based in Ramallah, this coming right before the economic side of Trump's infamous deal of the century, which was to be announced. Whilst the U.S. president was cutting funding from Palestinian programs, the $3.8 billion in foreign assistance for Israel was left completely untouched, as Trump approved at least $500 million in assistance for Israeli air defense weaponry. And who could forget the so-called deal of the century, revealed in February of 2020, which essentially condemned Palestinians to living in South African apartheid-style Bantustans, with no state at all to speak of. Trump did not stop, however, continuing on his quest to be the biggest gift to Netanyahu that keeps on giving. The U.S. president left a window open for Israel to deliver the campaign promise of Netanyahu, going ahead with a de jure annexation of the West Bank. When Benjamin Netanyahu realized that this was a move which would cost him too greatly, understanding that the West Bank has already been annexed in reality, Netanyahu then needed a way out. But luckily, Netanyahu's savior, Trump, came to the rescue and put normalization deals on the table with the UAE, Bahrain, and later Sudan, which gave the perfect distraction Israel needed. With Trump almost reaching election day, the gifts didn't stop coming. The Trump administration in late October signed a deal with Israel extending its scientific cooperation deals with Israel into the West Bank and Golan Heights, making the U.S. complicit in war crimes. Then a few days later, Trump signed off in a symbolic middle finger to the Palestinians and to the international community by allowing U.S. citizens born in Jerusalem, Al-Quds, to have their place of birth on their passports altered to say Israel. Since the mainstream media announcement that Joe Biden is the USA's president-elect, the Trump-Netanyahu alliance has not fallen apart. In fact, since Netanyahu congratulated Joe Biden on his win, the Trump administration has seemingly made it a priority to make sure Israel is in the best position possible to destroy any prospects of a two-state solution talk going ahead under Joe Biden. Israel immediately began upping its illegal home demolition campaign in East Jerusalem al-Quds, which has this year broken all previous records for the number of Palestinian homes demolished in the occupied territory. Israel's Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu then announced plans for the establishment of a new settlement adjacent to the besieged Gaza Strip, whilst Israel's Minister of War, Benny Gantz, announced 1,700 additional settler units would be built in the West Bank. Israel's Jerusalem al-Quds municipality then announced and approved the construction of 100-plus settler units inside of Ramat Shlomo settlement, which was supposed to be a red line for the international community due to the fact that it helps encircle East Jerusalem al-Quds with settlements and cuts it off from the West Bank. Then it was announced that Israel was going to build up its settlement known as Givat Hamatos, which would effectively isolate East Jerusalem al-Quds from Bethlehem. On top of this, during Mike Pompeo's most recent visit to Israel, Netanyahu reportedly requested permission to expand the Atarot settlement in East Jerusalem al-Quds, which could cut off the area from the West Bank city of Ramallah. This year alone, almost 1,000 Palestinians have been made homeless from illegal Israeli home demolitions, whilst Palestinians are being expelled from their homes. Israel is simultaneously expanding illegal settlements in strategic areas, which would further cut off Palestinian cities and towns from each other in the West Bank and East Jerusalem al-Quds. To rub salt in the wounds of the Palestinian people, the Trump administration's Secretary of State, Mike Pompeo, just visited illegal settlements in the West Bank and Golan Heights. Pompeo endorsed a winery in an illegal settlement and declared that not only were settlement products to be labeled as products of Israel proper, but that the U.S. was declaring that the BDS movement was anti-Semitic and coming after those supporting it as if they were members of the KKK. New settlement expansionist plans are being released every week now, with no meaningful international pushback and endorsements from the U.S. Trump administration, along with the new home demolition orders. Israel and the U.S. are working together to ethnically cleanse the Palestinian native population of Jerusalem al-Quds and to destroy any prospects for a two-state solution.
And Norbert, I look at that and I see a classic case of the tail wagging the dog. Thanks for a job so masterfully done, Robert and Lakesh, with those two stories for us. And thank you. Stay tuned.
In the limelight. President-elect Joe Biden is expected to nominate retired General Lloyd J. Austin III, a former commander of the American military forces in Iraq, to be the next Secretary of Defense, according to two people with knowledge of the selection. If confirmed by the Senate, General Austin would make history as the first African-American to lead the country's 1.2 million active duty troops and the enormous bureaucracy that backs them up. The article you're about to hear has been written by the New York Times journalists Helen Cooper, Jonathan Martin, and Eric Schmidt. The piece is titled, Biden Plans to Tap Lloyd Austin, Former Iraq Commander, as Defense Secretary. President-elect Joe Biden is expected to nominate retired General Lloyd J. Austin III, a former commander of the American military forces in Iraq, to be the next Secretary of Defense, according to two people with knowledge of the selection. If confirmed by the Senate, General Austin would make history as the first African-American to lead the country's 1.3 million active duty troops and the enormous bureaucracy that backs them up. General Austin, 67 years old, was for years a formidable figure at the Pentagon and is the only African-American to have headed the U.S. Central Command, the military's marquee combat command, with responsibility for Iraq, Afghanistan, Yemen, and Syria, most of the places where the United States is currently at war. General Austin is known as a battlefield commander, but he is less known for his political instincts and has sometimes stumbled in congressional hearings, including a session in 2015, when he acknowledged, under testy questioning, that the Pentagon's $500 million program to to raise an army of fighters in Syria had gone nowhere. He was selected over another frontrunner, Michel Flourny, who had served in senior Pentagon policy jobs and mentored a generation of women in national security who had pushed for her appointment as the first female defense secretary. Joe Biden, who is meeting with NAACP leaders on Tuesday, was facing pressure from the Congressional Black Caucus and other black officials to name an African-American to run the Pentagon or the Justice Department. But he skipped over Jay Johnson, a former Secretary of Homeland Security and former General Counsel at the Pentagon, considered by many to be more politically astute pick for the first black man to head the Defense Department. It was unclear on Monday night, 7th of December, what tipped the scales for General Austin. People close to the transition noted that during the Obama presidency, Joe Biden was unhappy with the high profile of the Pentagon, with generals like